Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every day talking about HR. Let's get to our guest. Adam, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Thank you, man. I'm happy to be here.
Sweet. We are happy to have you. If you could introduce yourself to our lovely family of listeners, and then we'll rock into what's top of mind for you.
Okay, that sounds great, man. I'm Adam Doherty. I'm a partner at the national and really recently international employment law boutique called Ford Harrison. I'm in the Dallas office. I've been practicing for about 15 years, all of it in Dallas. And I'm also board certified in employment law by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization.
Well, that's awesome, man. And we have some great weather here in the Metroplex, right?
Oh, all the time. It's very exciting. We had some tornadoes here yesterday and hail that I was told are the size of golf balls yesterday, and today it's absolutely gorgeous. So
And Brian, you know, you have the Brian lives up in Tulsa and has similar weather patterns as us. But I mean, Jim Snyder at Brian, you know Jim. He posted photos of golf balls. Like, he put golf balls next to the hail. Like, when people say golf balls, you're like, yeah, okay, really? It was like an acorn. No, these were literally golf ball size hail.
Some of the biggest balls I've seen in a long time. There's no doubt.
So awesome.
Check out you guys should check out Deadspin.com right now. They've got a picture from the AA game in Frisco, Texas, which is a north suburb of Dallas from yesterday, and it's a pretty incredible picture with a. Yeah, beautiful picture of the ballpark and then a big tornado in the background while they're playing.
Oh, nice. So hey, we're going to get into some employment law stuff today. So let's do this. What's top of mind for your clients? So like right now, if you were to kind of survey your clients, what's keeping them up at night from an employment law perspective?
Well, I literally just emailed one of my clients back about some FLSA issues, and probably have emailed three others this morning about that. So FLSA issues are definitely at the top of everybody's minds these days. And then in connection with the email I just sent, that was in relation to non-competes as well for independent contractors and their effect on the FLSA. And it seems like maybe at least here in Texas with the economy picking up, that non-competes are kind of at the forefront of everybody's minds. And then also what I'm seeing is, clients are still really interested, probably because of the economy too, about ways to keep fees down, you know, whether that's through arbitration agreements or questions about EPL insurance, you know, employment practices liability insurance. And then the fourth that I'm seeing, actually just wrote a legal alert about it, posted it to my Twitter account and my LinkedIn account, about a recent Fifth Circuit decision. The Fifth Circuit is the Court of Appeals that is over Texas, and they just issued a very pro-employer decision, which is kind of out of line for most of the decisions we get here. And it basically concerns, the NLRB coming into a non-union company and tearing apart their confidentiality policy because it, you know, here in this case, they said it basically prohibited the employees from talking about their wages. So those four things where you have the FLSA and non-compete agreements, the NLRB's reach into non-union companies, and then, you know, keeping costs down through arbitration or EPL, those are the four big things that it seems like I'm talking to my clients about almost every day.
So non-competes, I think most people that are, you know, not lawyers, but most people that practice, they probably don't really understand it's basically like, so let's just take Texas. They probably don't understand what you can and can't do. And what I've always kind of at least kind of understood is the more specific, the more better. Like the vague, you know, you can't go work with, you know, any firm like ours for 20 years. Yeah, okay, that's probably going to get kicked out. Like, I don't know if I've heard this or just learned it through the years, but the more specific, the better. So first of all, take all that apart. What should we be thinking when we think of non-competes?
Sure. Happy to go there. And let me tell you the first big misconception about non-competes is that, at least here in Texas, is that you have to receive money for them. So in essence, you got to be paid a bonus or something like that. And I've probably had literally three conversations to that effect over the last, you know, 24 hours where clients were saying, well, how much do I have to pay my employee to get them to sign a non-compete? And actually in Texas, that the amount of money you pay somebody really has nothing to do with whether a non-compete is enforceable or not. In Texas, the reason why non-competes are enforceable is if you're doing it to protect your confidential information or some sort of highly specialized training or just a ton of goodwill through your customers that you allowed your employee who's going to sign the non-compete to access. So that's really the basis of having a non-compete. So if you have an employee who, you know, maybe he's an hourly employee who, you know, doesn't receive any sort of confidential information, isn't a manager or anything like that, trying to enforce a non-compete against that person, even if the person signs it, is going to be pretty difficult. But from a Texas point of view, what they're looking for, to go back to your kind of initial thought, is they are looking for specifics, and really just three. They're looking for a reasonable geographic scope, a reasonable temporal scope, so as far as timing, and then just a reasonable overall scope of what you're trying to limit. And so typically what courts will look at, you know, like your example, 20 years is definitely not going to fly. It's typically, you know, 6 months to a couple of years. The geographic scope, you know, typically what courts might be looking for is, you know, a 50-mile radius or something like that where around where the company might have, you know, a location. And for the scope, it's typically limited to the type of business that the employee was already working in or maybe to the customers that he was soliciting. And these are all high-level concepts, so it's really a fact-specific test. So, you know, if you have a national employer, a court might say, okay, you know, a geographic scope limitation of the entire country in that case might actually be reasonable. It's really a fact-specific test. But like you were suggesting, you know, the idea behind the TRO and getting your non-compete enforced is that you're putting somebody out of a job, which, you know, obviously is a pretty big piece of relief you're asking for. So you really want to be on the judge's side or the arbitrator's side when you're asking for this relief. So the last thing you want to do is walk in there with an overbroad non-compete agreement.
So is it a good idea generally? Like say you and I work at Deloitte and our non-competes. Is it a good idea to name competitors of other firms that they can't or we would like for them not to go work for?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I typically do that in the non-competes that I draft. You know, if the client says, you know, here are the competitors that we're really worried about, are folks going to, I have no problem at all of listing those. Because, you know, at the end of the day, again, the judge is going to look at it, and the judge is, in his mind, is essentially trying to figure out, hey, what's fair in this instance? So if you have the specific companies listed, you could say to the judge, look, we told this individual on the very first day he started working that if you come and work for us, we give you this confidential information, give you this training, we're going to expect you not to go work for these other companies for, you know, whatever time period after. And I think that's a really good way to approach it from the very beginning, because I think that increases the chances of having the non-competes enforced.
How do you advise, let's say someone hasn't had non-competes, so they're working in a machine shop and it's just never been on a part of their bit, and they wake up and they find themselves in a fairly competitive landscape. How do they go back in to their employees and say, hey, by the way, we now don't want you to ever leave and work with these other persons. So it's the after the fact stuff. How do you?
Yeah,
what's
and
your
that
best
that
advice?
Happens a lot, especially. You know, again, here with, you know, my manufacturing clients and the economy picking back up, you know, they might be growing or they might realize, man, we're making a lot more money than we used to. And so they're perfectly in their right to go and, you know, offer kind of what we would call a midstream non-compete. You know, there's no rule, at least in Texas, that says you must sign a non-compete only on your first day. It's certainly something that you can provide to your employees, you know, after they've been working for you. And just like an arbitration policy, you know, you can pretty much enact these at any time. You know, the way I would do it is, you know, advise my clients, be upfront with your employees, be honest with them, and explain why this is something that you're going to be requiring going forward. And, you know, what you say is, hey, this is really a term and condition of the employment. So, you know, if you want to stay here, you really do need to sign this. And, you know, typically that goes over okay. I mean, the employees understand business and the way it works. And if it's, you know, something that they're not willing to sign, you can always negotiate individually. Or, you know, if you want to take a hard line, you can say, well, that might need to be the end of our relationship there.
So non-solicit, most people think when they think non-solicit, they think customers. So we would like to take that machine shop, and we don't want you to go work for these other three machinist shops, but also we don't want you to take our customers. I've also dealt with that in my history. I've dealt with that in terms of employees. Like, we don't want you to also solicit, you know, you're leaving. We don't want you to then go pull out five guys from our firm. So, first of all, I might or might not have that correct, so please tear that apart. But also, what do we do with folks that leave and then come back in and basically troll our firm and then pull people out of our firm?
Yeah, the best way to prevent that is to have, you know, part of the non-compete or an employment agreement or even just a side agreement. The best way to handle that is to have something specifically in writing. And, you know, it's a fairly common type policy or provision. And you simply say, you know, for a year or whatever time period after, you're not going to solicit any of our employees. And so long as it's generally reasonably written, courts will enforce that. If you don't have something in writing, it becomes a very uphill battle to prevent that from happening, because what courts typically say is, hey, you know, this is America, people are free to compete, and there's just not really a lot of what we would call common law duties that employees will have that will prevent them after they leave from doing something like that. But the interesting thing is, it used to be when I first started practicing that you could almost have that kind of non-solicit for employees be something that's 20 years or longer. Mm. And what some of the courts have recently started to do is really to apply kind of the non-compete principles, reasonable time, reasonable scope, to going after employees. And what I've seen a few courts do recently, you know, typically the way these are drafted are you can't recruit any employees. Well, what some of the courts are saying is, okay, well, you know, what that typically means is you don't want to hire away your salesmen or your executives. What if you want to go and hire the janitor or maybe an assistant that you had who is really valuable to you, but from the company's perspective is really somebody they could be just fine without? And so some of the courts are kind of tearing it down at those provisions in that way. But the good thing about Texas, and which a lot of people don't know either, is that Texas will do something called blue penciling. And what that essentially means is a Texas court has the authority to rewrite a non-compete agreement that might be overbroad to be reasonable in scope. And so, you know, the common perception for non-competes that a lot of employees and employers have is, man, these are really difficult to get enforced. But in Texas, at least, that's not really the case, because these judges have a lot of authority to rewrite it, and oftentimes they must rewrite it. But the part of the trade-off for doing that, and it's written into the statute here, is that the employer who's trying to enforce the non-compete will not be entitled to any damages for a violation of the non-compete up through the time of the blue penciling. So essentially, it's kind of the trade-off for having to rewrite the non-compete. The employer essentially can't get any damages for any harm that that he might have suffered up through the time of the rewriting.
All right, we got Brian and I have to move on and get you to talk about the NLRB. So first of all, just general take, what is going on? Who is running the insane asylum, and what are they doing?
Well, I tell you what, my office here, we're pretty unique in that once every 2 or 3 months, we try to bring in a representative from the various federal, governmental agencies. And about a month or two, we had the regional director from the NLRB come in, and I got to say she's absolutely fantastic. If you ever get a chance to hear her speak, she's very, very entertaining and very colorful. But obviously, as a person who defends companies for a living, I really disagree with a lot that she has to say. I agree, I think, with you guys. There's just a big reach from the NLRB, real big power grab, and they're really trying to expand their authority. And, I mentioned in my intro that my associate and I just, wrote a little legal alert, which we posted online. And it's from the Fifth Circuit, very pro-employer court. And it essentially, struck down an employer from Fort Worth. They were a non-union employer. It struck down just their very typical confidentiality policy that you'll see in handbooks or, standalone policy that most employers have. And the relevant part simply reads, if you're going to work here, you need to keep our financial information and our personnel information confidential. So the NLRB had a huge problem with that, with the idea being from the NLRB's perspective that prohibits an employee's right to essentially unionize because it prohibits them from discussing their wages. And so, the NLRB, won employer appeals, goes all the way up to the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit, based on the precedent that we now have, upheld the NLRB's decision. So that's, from my perspective, that's kind of a shocking decision, and it's a decision that has, I think, a lot of ramifications that are really negative to employers, but, it's becoming the law of the land, that's for sure.
All right, micro units. A buddy of ours, a guy named Michael Vandervoort, who has worked all over the place, but most recently at Publix and really kind of assist on that side to keep Publix non-union shop. He was telling us about micro units and how basically we're starting to see a trend, especially in restaurants and things like this, where people are forming smaller clusters or groups of employees that are trying to go that route to becoming union or a union shop. What's your take on that? What's your take on kind of that approach?
Employer, I certainly don't like that approach. But my firm, we do represent just a ton of restaurants across the country, and there's no doubt about it. That is the latest trend to try to go that way. And they're having some success, and we have a team of folks who that's all they do is what we would call traditional labor, and it's pretty interesting. As an attorney who came up here in Texas, as you guys know, we just don't have a huge union presence. So the reach that I discussed, in the legal alert in the Fifth Circuit that the NLRB is taking, where they're really extending out into the non-union workforce, at least from my perspective, has been fairly interesting because it's finally, really introducing me to the NLRB. But, from what my colleagues are telling me and what I'm seeing with my clients, the micro units, it is a very popular route that the unions are taking. And I know my guys who, work on this stuff day to day are being challenged by that and are dedicating a lot of time to it.
So let's say, the first time this happens inside of a restaurant, what's because, you know, you obviously you have a lot of these clients, but let's say it's the first time it's happened to somebody, and maybe they're not a client, maybe they're a prospect at this point. What's that first call like? Like, it's never happened to them. They've always treated their employees really well, always had been best places to work or whatever, and they've just never – this has never come up. And all of a sudden, now it's coming up. What's that first call for you like?
You know, it's kind of like really any other call we get from a company who is not, you know, just isn't involved in a lot of litigation from the employment perspective and just doesn't have a lot of, you know, employment disputes. And it's always, you know, just a big shock, right? It's always such a big surprise. It's like, hey, we've been doing the right thing. We treat our employees right. Why did this happen to us? And we see that a lot with just your typical discrimination litigation too. It's like, you know, hey, we did the right thing here. We treated this person right. We followed our policies. Why did we get sued? You know, and you guys probably hear this too. And what it feels terrible to have to explain it to them, but it's like, you know, unfortunately, this is America. It's kind of the world we live in where you could treat your employees perfectly, and for whatever reason that is personal to them, they're either going to bring a suit against you or, by God, we're going to try to unionize you guys. And so then it becomes, you know, a lot of counseling, a lot of explaining the big picture and really walking them through their options and alternatives. And it's really the reason why I like being an employment attorney, because you know, while we're in court a lot, we also just do a ton of counseling, and that's where you really get to know these folks and know their business and, you know, can really try to help them out in preventing the litigation that becomes so costly, you know, down the line.
And it's, you know, that's a subject that we could do like 10 shows on, that is so, so deep and so complicated. So when you get a call, just to kind of stick on the same kind of line of thought, when you get a call from an executive, owner, somebody is like, I just want this to go away. I'm running a business. I want this to go away. I mean, how do you approach that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You really have to get a feel for the client's business. And I think you really have to give them honest advice and really give them an opinion. And I know these – my clients, what they tell me is they like the fact that I'm, you know, not afraid to truly give them my thoughts, because that's what clients are really seeking when they're wanting legal advice. And especially as I get, you know, more advanced in the practice and having done this for about 15 years now, I honestly find myself giving more kind of just big picture economic advice, where, you know, trying to really convince the employer, especially one that feels like, hey, I've not done anything wrong here, it's really giving them kind of the cost-benefit analysis of, okay, well, you know, I have no doubt you did everything right, but here are the costs that you're going to face in order to prove that. And, you know, it's kind of unfortunate the way the system is set up. You can have an employer who's done absolutely nothing wrong, who would never discriminate, has all the policies in order, and it's going to cost quite a bit of, you know, time for them and then attorney, you know, time and fees in order to vindicate themselves in court. And that's always a big shock to, you know, companies who really aren't involved in a lot of litigation, just the amount of time and expense and effort that it takes. And so the last thing from at least my perspective representing companies that you want is, you know, to be 5 or 6 months down the line and, you know, you get the company a great, you know, result, and then they see the legal fees and it comes as a shock to them. Because, again, it does, you know, cost money to really do that. And so with my clients, I really try to be upfront, really try to give them a good feel, a good budget, a good estimate for what it's going to cost. My firm is very entrepreneurial, so we're really good with alternative fee arrangements and really trying to work with the client so that, you know, the rate or the fees that we're billing make sense for us, but that they also make sense for the client too.
Yeah, that's probably it just sends me into an absolute tailspin. when companies just have to spend money to basically just go through the process. There's, I mean, there's like no question that they're in the wrong, and it's going to be $100,000 to litigate it and prove yourself right, or $6,183 to settle and be done with it, right? And it's like, well, what do you do? You know, you got to make the decision. It just pisses me off, and then you just hear that over and over again. And anyway, life's not fair, and neither is that. So what are you going to do?
Well, you know, one thing to do is, and it was one of the four big things I mentioned at the start of our talk here, is clients should really consider, companies should really consider whether they should, you know, adopt an arbitration policy. And especially, you know, this kind of brings back the NLRB too. The great thing about arbitration policies nowadays is that you can put a class action waiver in there. And of course, the NLRB isn't down with that, but really all 50 states are, including even California, you know, whereby you put a class action waiver into your arbitration agreement, and, you know, you can feel very confident and comfortable that you're never going to really face a class action or a collective action under the FLSA. I've seen cases where, or examples where we've had, you know, opposing counsel call up, you know, pounding on his chest, we're going to bring a collective action against you, you've got all these misclassified employees, and so on and so forth. And we tell them, well, hey, are you aware of the fact that, you know, your client and your clients have signed an arbitration policy with a class action waiver in it? And then you just hear silence on the other side. And then on two occasions, we've never even heard back from them. And so from my perspective, a lot of defense attorneys don't really like the arbitration policies anymore for various reasons. But I think from a position of having some certainty about the type of liability you might face, I know a lot of my clients, CFOs, just love the fact that when you have an arbitration policy in place, you can feel fairly certain you're never going to get hit with a huge class action. And then you can also feel certain that you're not just going to get, you know, a runaway verdict in front of a single arbitrator or a panel of three arbitrators, where every time you go to court, even if you've got all the facts along your side, you're always essentially rolling the dice that you might hit something or get hit with something like that.
Yeah, well, we definitely need to get that in place to drive through HR. I would hate for any of our three people to get all crazy and want to do some form of a class action. So I might need to talk to you offline about that, Adam.
All right, we can do that.
So, but I guess you do have. I guess you don't have to actually have class to be able to put it that. Anyway, different subject. So we've only got about 2 minutes left. Time flies when it's a great conversation and fantastic, fantastic content today, man. Conversation was great, but I want to give you just a little bit of time. Tell people where they can follow you. I mean, you're really active on social and see what you write, connect with you. Let's just give you some time and then we'll roll on out. It's the weekend.
Yeah, that sounds great, man. I really appreciate that. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm also on Twitter under Texas Labor Lawyer. Phone number is 214-256-4706. Feel free to reach out to me any way you'd like. I'm a 24/7 attorney, so I'm always checking email, always answering calls and even text messages, you know, all hours of the day and throughout the weekend. And, you know, would love to connect. My law firm is great at putting out free content. If you send me an email at adoherty@fortharrison.com, I'll sign you up for that free content, which means you'll be getting legal alerts like the one I mentioned today sent to your inbox. And then you'll also have access to our library that houses, you know, legal alerts going back a number of years. It's a really, really fantastic resource.
Well, man, that's fantastic. Have a great weekend. Thanks for spending lunch with all of us. Folks, have an absolutely epically kick-ass weekend. Later. It might seem-